Well, good evening, everybody. Exodus chapter 18. You might remember we concluded chapter 17 last week. All 16 verses of it. Tonight we jump into Exodus 18, which is at 27 verses. There's a possibility we get through all of this tonight because of just the way the text lays out. Reading through this this chapter this week, this is not going to be one of those chapters that you remember from Sunday school or that is a chapter that jumps to your mind probably because of some great big event like we've seen so often in the book of Exodus. This chapter is a little different than the other chapters in the way that it's fit in here. I think there's some very important practical applications out of this chapter. I think there's some good church, or not just church, but just the way hierarchy structures should work in this chapter. And you're already probably thinking, what in the world are we going to, this doesn't sound like nothing like what we've been studying so far. But Moses will come back in contact with his father-in-law, with his wife and children in this chapter, who've been away for a while, if you remember. So I don't know that I can build it up any more than that, because it might seem as we're walking through it, I guess it's, I could say this, that this seems almost anticlimactic compared to what we've been studying. But there's some very important truths in this chapter as well that I think would do us well to spend time in. And since we're walking through it verse by verse and book by book, we're going to spend some time in it anyway. So with all that being said, let me go to the Lord in prayer before we begin. Father God, we thank you for this day you've given to us. And Lord, even the breath in our lungs is a gift from you. So God, we're grateful that we find ourselves once again back here in this place to open God's word together, to enjoy time together, to fellowship together, to catch up on the events of life amongst the family of God from last we were together on Sunday till the middle of the week. Lord, this is a glorious time for us to come together and study your word, as any time would be and is, but we're grateful that you've given to us to set aside this time to do this. Lord, I pray that you open our hearts and our minds to see what you would have us to glean from the truth of your word this evening. As we study this encounter with Moses and his father-in-law, there's some very applicable things for us to take from this, as there always is. God, I just pray that you be with us. Be with the kids next door and be with Michelle as she leads them. We ask these things in Christ's name. Amen. There is a somewhat, I don't know if natural is the right word, but there is a break point in this chapter. So we'll try to get there and see how we're doing on time. But with all that said, let me just jump in on verse 1, chapter 18 of the book of Exodus. Now Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how Yahweh had brought Israel out of Egypt. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife Zipporah after he had sent her away, and her two sons, of whom one was named Gershom, for Moses said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land, and the other was named Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness where he was camped at the Mount of God. And he sent word, some translations say said right there, word to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. So we'll stop right there. Jethro, the priest of Midian. What, have we met this guy before in our study through the book of Exodus? Oh, you look stunned. I know it was a long time ago. Exodus 4 was the last mention of him, at least. The last mention. We know who he is. It tells us a couple times here, right? This is Moses' father-in-law, so the dad of his wife, Zipporah. So the 40 years that he was out there himself, this relationship would have bloomed and he got married and that kind of thing. So that's who Jethro is. What is this priest of Midian? What does that mean, priest of Midian? First of all, what's Midian got to do with anything? It's an area, location, a people group. It's just another group of people, right? Not the Israelites, not somebody else, but Midian, this area and this people group. Does this mean he's a priest of God? It says he's a priest of Midian. What's does that mean? We talked about this a little bit, but it was all the way back in Exodus 4, which nobody remembered when we were there, apparently. Not quite 2 years ago. We haven't been in Exodus that long. So that was the last time we saw him, was then. The priest of Midian, that just talks about him being a priest in this area. And it could also mean like a title of authority, but there's some religious overtones that we'll look at as we study into this a little further. This doesn't mean that he was a priest of Yahweh God in Midian. That's not what it means here. We have some indications later on of perhaps some allegiance to the God of the Bible. We'll get to that in just a minute, though. So what does the text tell us here? Tell us who he is, and he heard all that God had done for Moses. Your translation doesn't say Lord. If you get a legacy, it does not say Yahweh there had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how Yahweh had brought him out of Egypt. So he uses the two different names for God in that same text. The first one there would be Elohim, which would be what? Y'all remember what Elohim means? Anybody? Well, if I was testing y'all tonight, you would be failing miserably. I'll let that sit, and we're going to come to that word again a little bit later on. Yahweh is the personal name of God, of course. So how had he heard about this? It says he had heard that all God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people. How literally Yahweh had brought Israel out of Egypt. So not just, I mean, he heard some little bit of details there, right? How had he heard about this? Moses' wife looks like she'd been with him, right? So how did he hear about what had happened in Egypt?
Yeah.
What's that? Okay. Brother Charles said God may have revealed this to him. What's another potential explanation? I heard the very broad statement that word gets around, but how does word get around in that time period? Okay. They're there and Pharaoh's not chasing them down. All right. Pony Express is actually closer to what possibly happened than what you might think, Marty. This would have been the main caravan route, remember, to get down to the Fertile Crescent. So people would have been sharing this story of what had happened and that these groups of millions of these Hebrews were on this side of the Red Sea now. So it didn't tell us specifically, but he'd heard for certain. So, and you remember when he left, he'd given him leave. You remember Moses went and asked leave of his father-in-law to go back to Egypt to get the people. So he knew that's where he was going. And of course, now there's millions of people there. So as we continue on, and Jethro, his father-in-law, took Moses' wife Zipporah after he had sent her away. Now, do y'all remember that when it says Moses sent her away in Exodus? And you remember, anybody remember that? Remember Exodus 4:20, it says, so Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey and returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of guidance. So when he left, he had them with him. What's this mean about sending them away? Anybody have that chapter and verse?
Four twenty.
He's leaving, heading there with them. Exodus 4, 24 through 26 is when Moses was to circumcise the children. So let me read that again. Now it happened at the lodging place on the way to Egypt that Yahweh countered him and sought to put him to death. And Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched his feet with it and she said, you are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me. So he let him alone. At that time she said, you are a bridegroom of blood, with reference to the circumcision. It doesn't tell us specifically about him sending her back, but he did. And a lot of people commentators are saying this is probably, after this event, it's probably like, all right, you go on back. This is a good time for you to go back. So there's some language about when it says sent her away, that it's a way to understand divorce, but that doesn't hold any water because they're married. Still married, he is addressed as wife. So don't think that way at all. And the two sons were with them too. One was named Gershom, for Moses said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. We might remember back when he named them. And it tells us literally, there's no explanation needed here, why he named him that, because that's what it means, right? The translation should show that, that's what it means. Gershom literally means a sojourner or stranger there. So that was the name of the first one, and it's likely a reference to Egypt, from where Moses had recently fled with Israel. Verse 4, the other one's name was Eliezer, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Eliezer means God is help. You know, we see El, anytime you see El at the front of a name, that's reference to God. So Eliezer, I've said it different every single time I've said it, I think, tonight. God is my help. What about this sword of Egypt, or the sword of Pharaoh? I'm sorry. Does everybody's translation say that at the end of the verse, the sword of Pharaoh? What does yours say? It didn't say sword of? Mike and Judy say two different things there. Yeah. Okay, I thought every one of them did. That's kind of an interesting term, interesting phrase. It's unique, and it's not really found anywhere else. I think it's pretty easy for us to understand what it's talking about. The sword of Pharaoh would mean his authority, right? His power, right? But I found something else interesting when I was thinking about that term or that phrase. In inscriptions from the New Kingdom, so the time of the Pharaohs, the reigning Pharaoh is given a title, Lord of the Sword. And the most well-known Lord of the Sword, as antiquity tells us, is Ramses II, who may have been the Pharaoh of Exodus, and what a lot of historians think was Ramses II, and he was the most well-known to bear that title. Take that for what it's worth. That's not scripture, but it has a connection to scripture at least. But it's power, prowess, etc. So then as we go on, so Jethro came with his sons, his wife, to Moses in the wilderness where he was camped at the Mount of God. Does anybody's translation say something different than the Mount of God right there? At the end of verse 5. I think every translation will say Mount of God there. Where is that? What is that place? We've already been there. We're there. That's also where the burning bush incident was. That's also where the rock was that Moses struck. What is this place? What is this Mountain of God? Mount Sinai, also called Mount Horeb. It's the same place. So that's where they're camped out at. Seems like there's something. The war with the Amalekites that we just looked at last week was right in the vicinity of that mountain as well. Remember, Rephidim was right there where the water, where there was no water at. It's all right there in that area. So that's where he finds him at. That's where he goes to. Now, verse 6 is where there's some differences in your translations. I read, and he sent word to Moses. Some of y'all's translations say, and he said to Moses, right? And it's about equal across the spectrum of English translations of half of them say sent word, half of them say he said. So how do we rectify that in our minds? Or do you need to? If yours says, and he said to Moses.
They both happened, didn't
they? They both happened, absolutely.
James says, had said, as if it was in past tense.
Okay. Because verse, and the reason I ask you if you got any confusion, right now you don't, I don't think. We're fine with either one, right? Verse 7, though, says what? Then Moses went out to meet his father-in-law. So he couldn't have already said it to him if he had to go out to meet him. Tracking?
He would have had to have sent word to him to let him know he's coming.
That's the thought process that most people fall down on. Is what Jim said is he had to have sent word to him that he was coming, which would mean what? He employed a messenger of some kind. Yeah. Somebody went in front of him to tell him, which if he's carrying the authority of Jethro, it could have been just as if Jethro said it. So the past tense works. See how it all works together if you just understand the totality of what's being said there and you understand all the nuances to it. Yeah. For a messenger to say something is as if Jethro himself said it, because he sent him to say it. So all is true because he had to have said it in past tense to know that he's coming to go out and meet him, right? I didn't want to confuse anybody, but I also didn't want you to look at that text and be confused that it said that. Then the next verse is, then he went out to meet him. So I see no difficulty in that. Apparently some people do, as I look through some commentaries and some people talking about it. When Moses went out to meet him, verse 7 says, he bowed down and kissed him, and they asked each other of their welfare and went into the tent. Let's pause on that verse for a moment. Do you find it interesting that Moses greeting and meeting his father-in-law seems to take precedent? And as we're about to read the rest of this, you'll see that it absolutely takes precedent over Moses being reunited with his wife and his kids. Do y'all catch that here? It doesn't say Moses ran up to Zipporah and the kids and gathered them in. It says he goes to Jethro, bows down to kiss him, and that's where the conversation starts. And the next verse will say they go, or it says then they go into the tent. Does that, what does that mean? Why would that be the case?
Protocol,
tradition, paying homage to him. In that world and in that environment, who was the higher authority? Jethro was, from a human standpoint, and tradition, and it's his father-in-law, so he was, I've never bowed down to Billy, but that's what they would have done back then. I hadn't done that either.
No kissing, right?
No. No. What about what they say? So what do they do? This is out in the open, right? They asked each other of their welfare and went into the tent. What does that mean, to ask somebody of their welfare? How are things going? This is not some weird language. We do the same thing all these years later, don't we? How's everything going? How are you doing? It's a pretty common greeting. But then they go into the tent. So this is informal. This is basic greeting, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, the language is literally like, how are you? Are you at peace? How is your welfare? It's kind of how they would have read it.
It's interesting, though, that Moses put details like that in and leave out something we wish you would put in.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's for these Bible study, you know, all these years later, I guess. So after the formalities, then they go into the tent. Why would they go into the tent next? Because this is a more personal discussion that's about to take place, and it's personal and formal than what's going on out in front of everybody else. Moses is the one, humanly speaking, leading these Israelites, right? Jethro's got this status position amongst those, you know, the people of that area. So they go into the tent, verse 8. And Moses recounted to his father-in-law all that Yahweh had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had befallen them on the journey, and how Yahweh had delivered them. So let's stop there again. What do you catch? What did Moses do? Not just in recounting, he recounted to him all that the Lord had done, that he'd done to Pharaoh, that he'd done to the Egyptians, for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had happened to them on the journey, and how the Lord had delivered them. What jumps out to you in that Moses commentary or description of everything that had happened to him?
It wasn't about him,
right? It was not, well, let me tell you what God let me do. God let me go stand up on that rock, raise his stick up. God helped have me do this. God had Aaron do that. No, God did it. Through the vehicle of humans, in some cases, but not in all cases, but that God had done it. And he'd done it what? For the sake of Israel, his people. That's a pretty good thing to, and he kind of starts and ends the verse with that, if you look at that, right? He starts off by saying, recounting all that Yahweh had done, and then at the very end, and how Yahweh had delivered them. So everything the Lord had done, and how the Lord had delivered them. Everything in between was just icing on the cake. What really happened and matters is that God did it. It is kind of a but God moment, isn't it? Sure enough.
But didn't God do this especially for his own glory?
Yeah, he did. He did do it for his own glory. At what point was Moses in his level of understanding to that level yet? We've seen a big maturity growth in Moses in our time of studying him this whole book, right? But was he at that point yet? Because I think back early Christian life of most of us, I would dare say, and you think about, y'all give God some credit for that, and we wanted to take a little bit of credit for it ourselves, right? But there's a point in your life, in your spiritual development, in your maturity, as the Holy Spirit is bringing you in conformity to the image of Christ, that there's a point in time when God reveals to you, this is all for my glory. You get the immense benefit out of salvation, right? And out of everything, but it's ultimately for God's glory. And that's when everything really changes, or it did for me at least, of understanding that reality. The good and the bad. Moses didn't leave out the hardships, does he? We had some hardships along the way. We had some things that happened to us. But God delivered us. How does the father-in-law respond to this? A priest of Midian, how does he respond to what God has done? And Jethro rejoiced. Some of y'all's translations say, I had it wrote down. Delighted, maybe? In over all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, that he had delivered them from the hand of the Egyptians. Pretty good response, don't you think? Pretty good response. This is interesting because I noticed that word is different in a couple of different English translations. So the Septuagint, which is what? The Greek translation of the Old Testament, right? The Septuagint translates it as if it comes from the root word, which is HRD, there's no vowel in that, which means to tremble or shudder. Like hearing the account of what had happened shook him to the core. Now he was delighted. It's kind of like the way and I don't want to go into a long rabbit trail on this. I've had a conversation with a couple of y'all when we think about the word awesome, how awesome our God is. This is kind of, it's this shuddering, trembling, but it's this overjoyed goodness at the same time. The meaning of awesome sure has lost its meaning in over several decades, I guess. The Jewish Midrash renders the verb as this: he felt cuts in his body. So this word has a lot of depth to it compared to what we use it, how we use it. So no matter how you look at it, there was a heightened response. Jethro was not just, man, that's a pretty cool story. I mean, this impacted him and affected him. And he was no stranger to the fact that Egypt was the strongest army in the known world, by far.
These acts of God were not an everyday occurrence.
That's another good point too, brother. Yeah. He'd never heard of anything like this happening. And never seen somebody who went through it, for certain.
Yeah. You think they were slaves. They were no soldiers like that. They were in the army. Yes.
And they just fought a battle against the Amalekites and won too. They watched God destroy the other ones, but they actually participated in the second one. So, yeah, all these, and we're picking out our favorite thing that happened of how amazing that is, but all these things combined, one of them's an amazing miracle. But think about everything we've read in Exodus up to this point that God had done for them. Yeah, that's what I mean. We could just sit here and talk about the rest of the time, all the things just we read about the first 18 chapters that God had done for them. We could do the same thing about our lives, too, if we really look at it. More than the next 40 minutes. So Jethro goes further, doesn't he? Verse 10, blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians, and he uses the word Yahweh, and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now, does that confuse you? He says, from the hand of the Egyptians, from the hand of Pharaoh, and from delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. There's all this stuff written up about this. It makes pretty good sense to me. First, he's talking about Moses, and then he's talking about the greater community of the people. That's the way I read it. You may read it any different than that. That's the way I mean, there's all this. People try to make something, a mountain out of a molehill here, and I don't think it is. I think Jethro's saying, I'm so glad that God delivered you and brought you out, and I'm also grateful that he delivered all these people. Yeah. We respond the same way, don't we? If somebody in our family is in something happens, boy, I'm so glad you're okay. But I'm also glad that the 30, 40, or millions of other people that were with you are okay also. It's personal first before it expands out. Now I know, verse 11, that Yahweh the Lord is greater than all the gods, lowercase g, for in this matter they acted presumptuously against the people. Okay. Now I know that Yahweh is greater than all the gods. Now he was a priest of Midian, so there was some other kind of worship going on there. For in this matter they acted presumptuously against the people. Some of y'all's translations say something other than presumptuously. Arrogantly, maybe some of your translations might say there.
Proudly,
arrogantly, same thing. Now I know is a expression used often in the Old Testament. We see a lot in 1 Kings and 2 Kings. It's usually used of a person being convinced of a truth by an event. They heard about something happening. Okay, that convinced me. That solidified it for me. That's not the same as the work of the Spirit on converting somebody, but that is this logical reasoning that takes place because of something that happened that causes you to understand it better or rationalize a little bit better. I don't think it means the conversion of Jethro because of what I just said. But from a human standpoint, it might look like that to him. Does that make sense? That's what it looks like sometimes in our conversion too, right? Oh yeah, it finally clicked for me. I finally figured it out. I finally know. But then as you grow in that maturity we talked about earlier, you're like, wait a minute. The reason I saw it, the reason I figured it out, the reason it makes sense is because God revealed it to me to begin with. But from a human standpoint, we see it from the other side until God expands us even more, right? But the second part of the verse is what I was talking about. It's sometimes difficult for people. Maybe not be for y'all because y'all are a lot smarter than these other people I'm talking about. Y'all laugh, but nobody said, no, you're not right. But what does this mean? For in this matter, they acted presumptuously, arrogantly, prideful against the people. Who are the they? Who are the they? Who acted arrogantly? Who acted pridefully? Who acted presumptuously? In the context of that verse. You think Israel? You said those who worshiped other gods. Y'all remember when we were going through the plagues, and I gave you all those pieces of paper if you were here, that talks about all those plagues and how they show the destruction of the false gods of Egypt, right? All these, the fish god and et cetera, water god, all that kind of stuff. So all of that is just arrogant pandering, posturing, because God proved, I think Jethro saw that as Moses probably recounted these plagues, and I think he saw clearer than we did. We had to have the sheet of paper and think about it. He knew about all those little gods. He was raised with them, absolutely. He saw how God was systematically destroying their false belief in all these pagan deities, is what I think is at play there. Then Jethro, verse 12. Moses' father-in-law took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God. So what's going on now? He's offering a sacrifice to God. How would he know to do this? Sacrifices to a god, lowercase g, was not uncommon in the world, right? Even a burnt offering wasn't. But where does that even come from? I debate on whether I go down this rabbit trail or not. I'm just going to step a foot or two on the path.
Oh, you're talking about? There's other peoples in the world doing the same thing.
Absolutely. That's my point, though. Billy said there's other people in the world that are worshiping all kinds of other gods that are doing sacrifices.
Built into man to worship, anyway.
Built into man to worship something. Absolutely. Where does that come from? Ultimately, God. Comes from Romans. Romans 1. Where does Paul get it from, though? When's the first time we talked about something happened a couple years ago. This really did happen 2 or 3 years ago in our study. Genesis 8:20, when Noah and his family came off the ark, what was one of the first things they did? Then Noah built an altar to Yahweh the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. You go all the way back to the flood. In regards to being able to... Billy's point is absolutely right. There's something innate in man to worship and oftentimes today it's worshiping self, but ultimately there's some kind of form of worship. But as far as literal burnt offerings, you go back to Noah. And guess what? If you didn't know it, everybody's a descendant of Noah. Every people group in the world is a descendant of Noah. That's a pretty good explanation for why there's a flood account for all these religions and all these cultures and everywhere, all in the world, right? Everybody came from that family of Noah. Through one of his three sons, but they all had the same daddy.
Have you ever plotted out the direction these sons went?
I handed that out when we were going through that.
Did you?
Yeah. I've got a copy of it somewhere that I can try to find it for you. It may be up here somewhere. But yeah, there is. That's where they get the curse of Ham, because that family group went down into Africa, and that's why for so many years, so many centuries, people tried to say it was okay to do this because Ham was cursed, and he went south into Africa. That's why people for so long thought that it was okay, justifiable, to think less of black people because of that. If they tried to justify it biblically or in some other way. Usually it's just straight up hate, because they don't look like me, right? But they really do. Is there something else going on here? Burnt offerings and sacrifices. What's the difference? Is there a difference? He says and, right? So it looks like there's something a little bit different there. So I kind of looked at what that means, literally, little translation. Sacrifice makes its meaning plain enough, impressing on the thoughtful worshiper the desire of God for truth in the inward parts and for a disciplined devotion. It depicts a general self-dedication, which is worked out in careful and painstaking details. So anybody can do a burnt offering. This is kind of like this is something internal. That we talked about this. We talked about the priesthood of the believers, right, and making spiritual sacrifices. This is something a little deeper than just going through the act of the sacrifice itself. But why did the elders and Aaron come together for all this? Does it look like something else is going on here? We haven't seen this in Exodus, but we saw it a few times in the book of Genesis. They had a meal together. There was a sacrifice. They had a meal together with the elders of Israel. Jethro was this person. This almost looks like covenantal type stuff, doesn't it? Like a covenant type thing happening here. Now, Moses was already in a covenant with Jethro in a way because he was married to his daughter. But this looks like something a little different, almost like that, doesn't it?
Like a tribal covenant.
So, it does look like that, doesn't it? The Bible doesn't go into that language, so I'm not going to go too far down that path. But that's kind of what it looks like. Seems to be. But also it might be something about the impact, the spiritual impact that's happening to Jethro here too, right? That he's seen in the spirit perhaps working here. So any applications to take away from that? I told you, this is not the grandiose stories that we've been reading in Exodus so far up to this point. But any other thoughts on this before we look at the second half of this chapter? Pretty straightforward, right? I mean, for the most part, pretty straightforward. Let's jump into the second half of the chapter. Because this is really split by 2 days, although we don't see it unless you read the text. Between verse 12 and verse 13, we have the next day. Verse 13. Now it happened the next day, for you King Jamesers, I think it says on the morrow. Now it happened the next day that Moses sat to judge the people. The people stood about Moses from the morning until the evening. Let's stop there for a second. What does it mean he's going to judge the people? What's he judging them about?
Settling their issues.
He kind of goes into that if we keep reading, right? That he's settling their issues. What's he judging them against? Had the law been given yet? We're at the foot of Mount Sinai, but he hadn't got the law yet.
He's still the leader, yes.
He's still the leader. They're still human beings. They're still going to be disputes and discrepancy and a lot of people, right? And there's going to be things you got to deal with. Now, this story is repeated pretty much one, Deuteronomy 1, 9 through 18. We'll read that if we have time, but Deuteronomy 1, 9 through 18. Some people try to debate the timing of this. People that get so spun up thinking, well, the law hadn't been given yet, so this had to be done after, because if y'all don't know, you got to talk about these big moments. Verse chapter 19, we start getting into talk of the law, that part of the story you know. People say, well, this must have been written after. Well, yeah, it was written after that. Moses wrote it after that, but it happened before because Moses put it here right before. Judging them on those kind of things. But he sat the judge, and he did it from morning until night. And Moses' father-in-law, so he hung around, saw all that he was doing for the people. So he said, what is this thing that you're doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, and all the people stand about you from morning until evening? So first of all, what is he not saying there? What is Jethro not saying? You don't have the right to. He's not saying you don't have the right to do this, right? He's saying, why are you doing this alone? Why are you taking all this from morning till evening? And like we said, this is a lot of people. And the more people you put together, the more problems you're going to have most of the time. What's that again, Diane?
There were shortages then that would make things difficult.
What do you mean by shortages?
Oh, you know, somebody had a place where they could buy water or food or something. I mean, you're still out in the wilderness scraping it up together. Territorial issues.
Family issues, territorial issues. I won't put my tent here. Your tent's across the line where my tent is. I mean, there's...
The goat's making noise.
I mean, these are pretty calm things compared to some of the other stuff they did, right? We're about to see some really bad stuff they're going to do here pretty soon. In the next chapter. So, he asked him a question. What is this you're doing for the people? It's kind of rhetorical, right? He knew what he was doing for the people. He saw what he was doing for the people. Why do you alone sit as judge and all the people stand about you from morning to evening? Moses answered him, verse 15, because the people come to me to inquire of God. That's not a bad thing to come inquire about, is it?
He's always been the one that spoke to them for God.
He's always been the one, he or Aaron through him, through God, have been the ones that have always spoken to him. So coming about these matters of dispute, he's straightforward. That's what they're coming for. I read something that talks about how that, you know, that's not out of the realm of antiquity where people would go to someone as an oracle to kind of speak the words of God. I don't look at it that way because they're really coming to them, it seems like, with judicial matters.
He's proved to them that he could hear from God because he's the one that would say something that happened in the Washington.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they completely, I shouldn't say completely. Well, I mean, yeah, they knew that he spoke as a messenger of God, as an oracle of God, from God.
Because
it happened. Yeah, absolutely. They seen proof was in the pudding, right? So they wanted to receive answers to legal disputes and the goat disputes and which all these disputes. Verse 16, when they have a matter, so he elaborates on it. He elaborates to Jethro and to us. When they have a matter, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor and make known the statutes of God and his laws. And Moses' father-in-law said to him, that the thing that you are doing is not good. Now, if we just stop right there, we'd be like, hold on, Jethro. You know, I know you just burned this animal and y'all ate together, but you were just praising God for all that he had done, but who do you think you are to tell Moses that what you're doing is not good? You got something? Well, the only thing they knew of that they had been observing was Sabbath, and they knew that God had told them to observe the Passover. That's really all that had been formally handed down. But that's a good question. He was asking about what these, he mentions literally laws there and statutes. And the law, we're not quite there. We're almost there, but we're not quite to the handing down of it. So what's he talking about? Anybody have any thoughts on that before I elaborate a little bit? Okay.
Every time he makes a ruling, he's going to make somebody upset. So you're leading people, you need them to want to follow you. You make half of them upset. That's your problem.
So how does that apply, though, to him saying?
If you have a bunch of other folks making these rulings, then it takes them to stop the leader.
So how does that still, though, back to the original question, I get what you're saying, back to the original question of how's he utilizing the law to make the determinations if they hadn't yet received the law?
Well, he's talking to God.
Okay.
He expects them to go to God to mediate, almost like the Catholic Church.
Yeah. There is a little bit of an idea of mediation going on here, for sure, of Moses being the intercessor between them. But, so here's a key point in this. He says, Moses says, I judge between man and his neighbor and make known the statutes of God and his laws. So they're not coming to him and saying, okay, Moses, this is what Jim did. There's so many Jims, I'll just say Jim because it could have been any of y'all. This is what Jim did. God's law says this, he's in the wrong. They couldn't do that because they hadn't received it yet, right? So who do they go to? They go to Moses, and Moses is intercessor. And he, to Diane's point when we very first started of, I'm not trying to pin this on Diane, but she made a comment earlier about sometimes we see Moses gives us stuff that we're like, okay, that didn't really mean a whole lot to me, but there's other things that it seemed to be withheld at times. So what God had given to him, and Moses had this relationship with God so much, though, he could give them the law of God. Like, you can break the law even if you don't know what the law is, right? Today.
Yeah.
We can break the law even if we don't know what the law is, and still we're guilty of breaking the law. So Moses is bringing God's law into account even if he hadn't been physically handed it yet. He had different authority than the rest of them did. So they're not coming to him and saying, oh, this guy broke, you know, commandment number 6. They're just saying, here's our dispute. And Moses was handling it per the way God is directing him to handle it. I don't know if that clears any of that up or not, but that's... I keep doing tonight. I'm not uncomfortable with silence. So I don't know why I keep doing that. But you know, that's why people do that, right? When they're talking publicly and they say all the time, usually that means they're uncomfortable with that silence. I usually don't have a problem with that silence, but for some reason I keep doing it tonight. So now I'm going to get quiet for a minute. Verse 17. For me, it's a thinking thing, I believe. Moses said to Moses' father-in-law, Jethro said, the thing you're doing is not good. Why would he say it's not good? You can't answer that yet. We're about to answer it in the text, okay? Verse 18. You will surely wear out, both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. So where is his father-in-law coming from a place up here?
Why does he even think they're doing it alone after all they've been through?
He's telling Moses, you're the only one sitting in judging all these from the most... Probably somebody slapped my daughter behind the tent. Somebody did something terrible. Somebody maybe even killed somebody. All the way down to Malia's goat stepped on my tent post. And he's handling all of it.
Well, Jethro is a leader, too.
So Jethro's a leader, too.
So he knew before. He'd already probably been down that road.
Is Jethro trying to get Moses to delegate?
That's the word we're looking for. He literally said, I think, do y'all see some familial, some true father-in-law concern here for this son-in-law that he loves saying, he literally, it's what he says, right? You're going to wear yourself out. And Moses is no spring chicken at this point either, if y'all remember that.
But God has used Moses through all of this.
He has. But also, we've got that whole human lens versus, you know what I mean? And he sits there and watches him. So maybe Moses had some tells, if we want to use that word. Because he sat there and watched him all day. He may have seen that it was so hard, that it was wearing Moses out. And maybe Moses was trying to make a lot of the decisions in his own power, too. And that was additionally wearing him out. I think he saw it in Moses. I think if Moses would have been just as strong at the end of the day as he was at the beginning of the day, he might not have thought the same way. But I think he saw it in him, that it was wearing him out. There's something else, too, though. All the people. I'm sure none of y'all have ever been to court for anything and stand before a judge, but Nobody laughed at that, did they? But if sometimes you might have to sit there all day long because there's one judge that you've got to see. And the delegation piece is huge. I like what Jim said. This Jim. I like what you said too, Jim, but this Jim, when he said, made the comment about Jethro was a leader too. He understood tasks and responsibilities. This is, I guess I got time to, whenever I was leading and developing managers in my workplace, and that my job was to lead and develop managers, make managers better managers. I did that for about 7 years. It's probably the favorite job I've ever had outside of pastoring. Well, second favorite after my time in the service. And that's what I told those guys all the time is you've got to learn how to delegate. Your best people that you can trust, even if it's peer-to-peer, you need to give some responsibility to them or else it will. Some of y'all shaking your head, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you ever let anybody, it will wear you out. Physically, mentally, emotionally, it'll tear you down. And so in Moses' humanness, that was happening. I think Jethro saw it. And again, he's old. There's no way to sugarcoat that. Moses is an old man. But it made me think, well, how much older is Jethro? That's his father-in-law. He's older than Moses. Anyway, I digress on that a little bit. But he says this, both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. So he continues to go back to the point that it's not about you, Moses, being able to do it, having the ability. You can't do it alone. You can't do it alone. Verse 19. Now listen to my voice. Still his father-in-law speaking to him. I will give you counsel, and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the matters to God. Then warn them about the statutes and the laws, and make known to them the way in which they shall go and the work they shall do. But you shall select excellent men out of all the people, those who fear God, men of truth, those who hate greedy gain. You shall place these men over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and tens. So stop there and go back to 19. Now listen to my voice, he says. And I will advise you, he says. I think if he would have stopped right there, then Jethro would have been out of bounds. He wouldn't have been in his heart humanly out of bounds because he's trying to look out for his son-in-law. The next thing he says to him is what's so impactful. What does he say to him next? And God be with you. Listen to my counsel. This is wise human counsel. To Jim's point, I've led people. I understand what it means. Listen to my counsel, but God be with you. If God puts the kibosh on this, then no. But here's my advice. Here's my counsel. That's good for us when we're giving advice to somebody too, isn't it? I mean, hey, this has happened to me in the past. Let me walk you through this, but I'm not the ultimate authority. God is. So let's take it to Scripture for us now because we've got the full count. We've still got the full Scriptures in front of us. We can do it a little bit easier than he could, of course. But that's how I read that. Anybody have any other thoughts on that?
It sounds to me like God was using Jethro to accomplish his purpose.
Y'all hear what Brother Charles said? I think that exact same thing. He said it sounds like to him God is using Jethro to accomplish his purposes. And that's, I'm not speaking for Brother Charles here, but I think this is what he means here too, that by him throwing that phrase in there, and God be with you, is kind of confirmation that that's what was going on. See, Brother Weeks, you need to leave that next man's devotional. We're trying to get you to do it. And he says, it's not ultimately his decision. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the matters to God. So Moses is going to be the ultimate authority to take it to God, right? All these people he's about to appoint, he says, they can bring it to you. They can't settle it. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Warn them about the statutes and the laws. That goes back to what Jim talked about earlier. Warn them about the statutes and laws. So that obviously means they didn't have them yet because you've got to warn them about them. They didn't have them yet. Make known to them the way in which they shall go. Obviously, they didn't have them yet. And the work they shall do. Now we get to the delegation piece. You shall select excellent men out of all the people, those who fear God, men of truth, those who hate greedy gain. You shall place these men over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and tens. What does that sound like right there, especially in the new covenant economy?
Well,
What's that?
Elders and deacons.
A lot of that same language is used right there, isn't it?
You can multiply Christian work by doing that.
That's another good point. Did y'all hear what Brother James said? See, James is a little more dignified. We call him James. I mean, we call it the Jim James, too, I think.
I have a chance to bug Jim.
Oh, you're, okay. Okay.
In quality of name. But Jim's coming along. He's going to make it.
You got another one right beside of you. Don't talk too loud. But yeah, did y'all catch what he said there? That as you multiply these leaders or you appoint these leaders, what does that mean, especially for us today? You multiply that witness, the effectiveness of getting the word out, the message out, and all that kind of stuff also. Of course, he's not specifically talking about evangelism here, but it bears the same thing. If you're taking the statutes and ordinances as been directed, then you have these other leaders. But yeah, absolutely, to Marty's point, this is a lot of the same language we read about in 1 Timothy and in Titus, isn't it, when he's talking about leaders and deacons and elders? It doesn't tell you to divide them up into thousands and fifties and tens, but this was militaristic in the way that this was set out. And that's from the very start when they came out of Egypt. It said they were aligned and arrayed in a military fashion, formation, if you will. And where does he start with? The most important thing for a leader that's following God, if the people you appoint must do what? Fear God.
It's interesting they didn't take into account 12s, because there's 12 tribes.
I think it's just because there's so many at this point and the way they're all arrayed and lined up. But I know what your point. Yeah. He probably didn't know that, would be my guess. Yeah, he probably didn't know. So what's he tell them? Men of character, virtue, integrity, men of strength, they fear God, men of truth. They ought to hate unjust, dishonest gain, be greedy. Why is that so important? Why is it so important that they don't choose somebody who has greedy gain? They could bribe them. Absolutely bribe them. Kelly has to work with some unsavory people from time to time, so she... So it's kind of a judicial hierarchy, but it's set up like a military administration, the way he's breaking them out into these groups and everything. But it's a big group.
It would be wonderful if judges today, a lot of them do, maybe judges today, if they had these qualities, life would be so good.
Because that's what he's setting up as judges, yeah. Yeah. Verse 22, and they will judge the people at all times. And it will be that every matter... Major matter, excuse me, they will bring to you, but every minor matter they themselves will judge, so it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. So what's he telling him? All these piddly things, Moses, that you're having to deal with, you've got people that are capable, that are able. Give them that responsibility. Let them lead. Let them judge. That's a hard thing for leaders to do, even today. The best leaders, it's easy for them. But somebody who's new in that, to me, that's the difference is, I'm not going to give y'all my whole leadership management speech, but you can teach a monkey to manage something. I truly believe leaders are born and given these qualities by God, but you can mold them, and you can make somebody a better leader. But anyway.
I think it's a big job to pick on these leaders. He's got kind of a big job there.
Yeah, I think you got to pick the ones...
Levels.
Yeah, he's not giving him a small task, is he?
That's what I'm thinking. He's added a little bit to his workload.
At first, yeah. In order to make it smoother. Which is the same thing whenever you give people delegate authority right now, right? You've got to teach them this is how it works. You got to pick them. You got to teach them. You got to show them. A lot of work on the front end for that the top leader. But then once that starts matriculating down, then it makes it easier. Okay. What about, I know we're running up out of time. We've only got a couple of verses left. And they will judge the people at all times. I've thought about that a couple of different times. And is he talking about like as a day-to-day going about life, that they're always there if there's a problem, and somebody just comes and grabs you up and says, hey, Kelly, let me tell you what happened. Or is it, Or is it for all time that they'll be the judge? I don't have an answer to that. Just something that I kind of thought about. Because the Bible didn't tell me the answer to that. So anyway, if you do this thing and God so commands you. So again, back to what Brother Charles said, he thinks this is God working through Jethro. I mean, ultimately, it's all God's work anyway, but directly working through Jethro here. As God so commands you, then you will be able to endure. And all these people also will go to their place in peace. What is he saying there? I think he's saying that these people aren't going to be standing in line for 15 hours. They're going to get it solved and resolved quicker. And it'll make them happier too. You're always going to have somebody that's not going to Mike's point earlier, you're always going to have somebody that's, if you're on the wrong side of the judgment, you're usually not going to be happy about it. But this is one of our own now too, right? This is somebody probably that's had a relationship with versus Moses, who not every single person in that group would have had that personal relationship with him either. So this is somebody in their own tribe, if you will, in their own camp, in their own area. That's something else that's important here. We complain about that all the time, don't we? In our representative form of government that we have?
Oh, yeah.
Am I representative this and this? Does your representative know your name? So Moses listened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. Moses saw that this is sound advice, didn't he? And that Jethro was saying, but go to God with it. But go to God with it. So that leads me to believe that Moses took it to God, don't you think? Moses was a man of prayer. And Moses chose excellent men out of Israel and made them heads over the peoples, leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and tens. And they judged the people at all times. The difficult matter they would bring to Moses, but every minor matter they themselves would judge. Don't you? You have to believe that Moses still stayed pretty busy. With that many people, there were probably still a whole lot of major issues. But he was able to get to them easier, more succinctly, and probably had a clearer way to respond instead of it being, you know, 8 o'clock at night when he's responding to them. Verse 27, then Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way into his own land. I mean, Jethro shows up, here's the story, says, praise God, he did this, I believe it, stays over to the morning. Seemed like there's any ulterior motive at all. Just came out and he sees what his son-in-law is going through and sees, and he goes like, let me see if I can help you. But take it to God. And he does help him. He helps him with some of that burden. So I found a Ligon Duncan has said this about this text. He says, in the words of wise counsel from Jethro, we discover that to establish justice and righteousness amongst the people, men who fear God are needed. He goes on to say, people in the Old Testament could not run properly or effectively without being led by men of sound judgment, great reverence, and personal holiness. The same is true of the church today. Only when church leaders such as pastors, elders, and deacons are righteous and reverent can God's people expect to flourish. Philip Ryken adds, the word of God being taught to the church is central and the key to the church's sanctification. However, it is not that alone. Discipline through judges or elders must be applied in the church situation. Only then will holiness and righteousness prevail in the church. A couple of interesting thoughts on that. Any other thoughts on this text tonight? Again, it's not a flashy text by any means, but there's some pretty deep truth there to that we can consider for sure. And again, I think I kind of like that. We always want those big moments that we read in the book of Exodus, but this shows us how relatable God is on these small things, and yet they're not inconsequential to God. They're not too small for God. They're not small things to God. Just as he's the same God who parted the Red Sea and brought millions of Hebrews through that same Red Sea on dry ground.
You got general court, you got the Supreme Court.